Today is Monday, June the 10th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speakers are Mary Carlson and Dan Spencer. They will be doing a five-part series entitled Bioethics and Faith. Session one today is entitled A Framework for Decision Making. Let's listen in.
The title of this session is Bioethics, Faith, and Session 1. This is a framework for ethical decision-making. My name is Mary Carlson. I teach social work at St. Olaf College, soon to be co-teaching bioethics with a philosopher at our college during the January term. So I'm pleased to be here today, and I'll let Dan introduce himself.
My name is Dan Spencer. I teach religion and ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Mary and my collaboration goes back. We met 19 years ago in Glacier National Park. We both were in school in Northfield at that time. I was at the other Northfield school at Carleton College. Mary is at St. Olaf. But we've managed to work through that and maintain a good
friendship. So it works well. We'd like to just do a quick first name thing because we suspect we're going to be fairly small. This is a nice size, actually, compared to what we thought we might have. Can you just give your first name? We're not going to spend a lot of time with introductions, but that
Mary
would be
nice. Mary Lou.
Nick. Scott.
Judy.
Lori.
Bob.
Liz.
Mike.
Nancy. Karen.
Jim.
Jamie.
Dan.
Terry.
Dan.
Okay, great. If we do Dan and do Jim and do Kari, maybe we're in good shape. Okay, thank you. Just a little bit about what we're going to hope to do this week. As most of you know, teaching sessions at the Village usually go week by week, and we're told we need to have a theme for the week, but each session needs to stand alone. So feel free to get a taste of what other folks are doing this week also. Our hope this week is to introduce all of you to some of the common terms and language used in bioethics in order to give you some common understanding about the issues that are arising, many which you maybe have already faced or may well face in your lives, and to give us some tools for thinking through dilemmas that arise in bioethics, current dilemmas and ones that we think are coming. We do try to have an emphasis on faith questions throughout, so we're going to try to be weaving that in as we go, and that's our hope for the week. We will use a case study approach, so each day we'll have a different case we'll be looking at together that we hope represents fairly common or emerging issues in bioethics, so they're not way out here as things that we'll probably not ever deal with as regular folks in the world, but things that we might well all be having to think about.
What we thought we'd do is start by simply getting your sense of how, when you hear the term ethics, what comes to mind? If we were to ask you, what is ethics, what were some of the answers that you would give? Anybody here? Ethics.
A moral judgment.
Moral judgment, right? A moral judgment. So ethics has to do with morality. We'll talk a little bit about what morality is there, but moral judgments. Other things.
Code of conduct?
Code of conduct, particularly when we talk about ethics in the professions or ethics in different areas, there are oftentimes codes of conduct that come with that, and that's a very important one for biomedical ethics, we'll be spending some time with. Other things, when you think of ethics.
To me, it's just the basic difference between right and wrong.
Right and wrong, difference between right and wrong. And when we do the field of ethics, we're talking about how do we discern what's right and wrong, how do we begin to think about that. Other things. Who does ethics?
All of us.
All of us. At some level, all of us do ethics. And we talked about this title being called, Who, Me, an Ethicist? There's sometimes we tend to think about ethics as what the professional ethicists do. And yet all of us are making these kinds of moral judgments, making decisions between right and wrong, whether we're doing it intuitively or consciously. We're all doing ethics in that sense. We can talk sometimes about ethics operating at these at three or four different levels. Then one is probably the most basic level is ethics operating at the gut level. Most of us get socialized into a framework of understanding what is right and wrong. So most of the time we're doing ethics without consciously thinking about it. It's the way we've been socialized to react to different ethical issues. And by and large, that works pretty well. I think for most of us, our intuitive guidelines, our sense of conscience, is a good guide for helping us to think through ethical issues. But there are times when we hit what we're going to be defining as ethical dilemmas, when simply our intuitive guidelines may not be enough, where we may need to take a step back and begin to think through more consciously, reflectively, systematically about how to resolve very difficult ethical issues. And when we talk about biomedical issues, that's what we're going to be looking at this week, is whether these issues are coming up. Now, just a couple of things in background here. What we'd like to do today is to give enough of a framework that we can begin talking to each other. So today is going to be a bit of giving us some common vocabulary, talking a little bit about how we work through some of these issues, and beginning to do a practice run through a case together. The rest of the week, we'll be focusing on a specific, different issue each time, built around a case study. So today, we're going to be throwing a few things at you. We'll try to make it interesting, help you understand why we're doing that. We've got these big newsprint sheets, which will help remind us of some of these. What I'd like to do now is to introduce some common terms in ethics. But let me mention a little bit about why biomedical ethics in particular has emerged as a very fast-growing and difficult field today. By and large, in Western society, in Europe and North America, and the areas that are influenced by those countries, has been shaped for the last 2,000 plus years by what's known as the Hippocratic tradition, or the Hippocratic Oath. Anybody familiar with what that is? We talk about the Hippocratic Oath, what are we talking about?
A doctor. Taking an oath.
Doctor taking an oath. Where does it come from? Anybody know? Greek, all right? We got Greek there. Anybody know who formulated, who all formulated the Hippocratic Oath?
Hippocrates.
So many ways. So 23, 24 centuries ago, Hippocrates got together with other physicians, with other healthcare practitioners to try and formulate ethical guidelines for the practice of medicine. And by and large, the Hippocratic Oath has been the main ethical tradition in the West for the last 20 plus centuries. And it's worked by and large very well. In the last 30 to 40 years, what has begun to change is the influence of medical technology. We now have all sorts of different situations that we're confronting because of medical technology that the Hippocratic Oath never was covered before, because those situations simply didn't come up. And so that's sort of some of the grounding about why biomedical ethics is emerging in such different ways. There simply were no ways to intervene in healthcare processes the way we have them now, in terms of organ transplants, in terms of genetic coding, the different kinds of issues that are coming up that we'll be looking at this week. The other thing I just want to acknowledge here, one of the things I think that makes bioethics so interesting is that it's always operating simultaneously at two very different but intersecting levels. We're going to be focusing on case studies because this is the way much of bioethics happens. When a person has a situation happen to them that calls for a decision, do we give this organ? Do we disconnect this life-sustaining technology? What do we do for this particular case? It's always focused very concretely on people, but at the same time, it always has public or social ramifications. In that sense, bioethics operates a lot like law does. It operates by precedence. And once you've established a precedence in a certain area, that gives guidance to further, to later discussions. So while we're focusing on specific cases this week, we want to keep in mind that the decisions we make also need to take into consideration the wider societal ramifications. And we'll keep that kind of in mind there. Now, let me just mention a few things here. Let me just mention a few of these here. Yeah, we won't go through all of these, but just a couple things. We talked about ethics involving moral judgments. A fairly basic definition of morality is simply the whole areas of our lives that deals with choices and behaviors which are deemed as right or wrong. And we'll see that this, the area of morality, is strongly culturally shaped. Cultures, religions, different traditions have different values about whether something is right or wrong in that sense, but morality is the whole area that deals with that. And then ethics tries to take a more systematic or reflective look at morality. We talk about ethics then being the systematic formulation of moral principles, rules, and standards that can give us guidance. So when we talk about do not steal, do not kill, these kinds of guidelines or standards, ethics takes a look at them and tries to help us think them through clearly, particularly when they begin to conflict. I like to say with my students at Drake that ethics is who we are and how we act in light of who we say we want to be and how we say we want to act. That is, ethics has a certain oughtness to it. It's who we ought to be, it's how we ought to act. So we have a set of values and standards by which we can judge, make moral judgments about who we are and how we act. An ethical issue, then, is any course of action that affects human well-being, in this case here. Any course of action affecting human well-being. Now, when we talk about environmental ethics, we're talking about well-being of ecosystems, things broader than the sense of humanity. But mostly we'll be looking at the well-being of human beings this week. A few other important things in this here that we'll be talking about. We're talking about the values that we have that shape how we think about ethics. And values in this sense we'll talk about is any deeply held belief or commitment. Any deeply held belief or commitment. Now, values by themselves can be either positive or negative. Value in itself is neutral in terms of its content. And I can give you an example. If you were to look at the values of Hitler's Germany in terms of racial purity, those kinds of things, most today would judge those as negative values. But they simply were the deeply held commitments or beliefs of a particular grouping of people. So values by themselves are always open to being justified. Why do we hold these values? Are these values still adequate? Do we need to rethink them? A part of ethics is getting clarity on our values and how they shape how we make decisions. Some of the other things we'll be talking about. Ethics oftentimes talks about the rights that we have. This, in our society, rights language is very pervasive. We talk about the right to free speech, the right to freedom of worship, the right to assembly. In that sense, rights are justified claims to something which others must respect. When we say, I have a right to free speech, that's a claim that's been justified that others have to respect. We have a constitution, a bill of rights as a way to justify that. We'll be talking about that this week. Do people have a right to die? When we look at the issue of physician-assisted suicide, that'll be one of the debates. That is, do people have the right, a justified claim to die that others must respect in that sense? Or is that not a right that we have? Oftentimes, the flip side of rights are what we call duties. And this is where when you brought up the professional's code here, code of conduct, these oftentimes outline the duties that a professional has in his or her area. And we'll be looking at that in the medical field. But duties are obligations held by an individual or an institution that they have the duty to uphold, the demand to uphold. They're oftentimes related to another person's rights. But if I have rights in one area, Mary may have the duty to respect those if she's my physician and I'm her patient. So we'll be talking about this relationship between rights and duties and how we define those. What happens when they're called into question? Just a few other things here. Responsibility is a broader area. It may contain many duties. We talk about parents having the responsibility for the well-being of their children, or governments having the responsibility for maintaining society. So we'll be talking about areas of responsibility and the kind of duties that go within them. Two more things I want to mention here, and then we'll start to see how these play out a little bit. And if these are not clear at any point, please stop me and speak up. But we're going to be focusing quite a bit of attention to ethical dilemmas. And we'll define an ethical dilemma as any time our values, principles, or actions conflict. Anytime our values, principles, or actions conflict. Okay. One that we'll be looking at later in the week, just to give you an example, is the whole area of physician-assisted suicide. Part of the professional codes of physicians is to promote the well-being of their patients and to preserve life. Are there extreme circumstances where that might mean causing death? Or does that violate the duty of the physician to preserve life, to maintain life? So you have a conflict there, perhaps, between the wishes of the patient who wants to die, and the duties of the physician who has a duty to preserve life. So we'll be spending a lot of time trying to get clarity on what are the ethical dilemmas and what's in conflict in them as a way for us to begin to think through these issues together. And the last thing that I have to, I don't know if you can see this, but we'll be talking about this two different forms of value, intrinsic value, instrumental value. When we say something has intrinsic value, what are we talking about? Intrinsic value.
Value within itself.
Value within itself. So the value that something has for its own sake without regard to how it affects others. And one of the assumptions of biomedical ethics is that persons, human beings, have value for their own sake, quite apart to their value for anything else. Simply by being born human, you have intrinsic value. Some people talk about this as a sanctity of life. Religious values come in oftentimes here, but intrinsic value is the value that something has for its own sake. Instrumental value, then?
Value from its use.
Yeah, the value you have out of its use. We can talk again about parents have important instrumental value in relation to their children. Okay, so the instrumental value can be an important one to look at sometimes in ethical issues. A basic premise of biomedical ethics, however, is that you never treat individuals simply in terms of their instrumental value. That is, all of us have value for our own sake, quite apart from our value to others. And where our value to others may be relevant, you can't simply use one person as a means to accomplish somebody else's end, that is, in terms of their instrumental value.
Which may come up in our case study on Thursday with procuring organs from infants who are not brain dead, but are dying.
Well, if these aren't all very clear at this point, we'll have a chance to be using several of these throughout the week. And what we've tried to do is design different cases and different issues that focus on different aspects of this. So by the end of the week, if you stick with us, you'll have gone through quite a few of these and see how they play out.
Okay, should I jump up and do those?
Why don't you do the ethical principles, Mary?
We're not trying to turn you all into ethicists, but we are trying to turn us all into people who can talk articulately, a little more clearly about ethical issues. In bioethics, there has been a fair amount of confluence of thought in the last 15, 20 years around some specific principles. There are critiques to these principles, especially now, that are rising within the field, and we can talk about those as they come up. But primarily, these top five we're going to mention, and then we've added some at the bottom. So let me just go over those briefly, and we'll leave these up through each session so that people can kind of look back. If you're like me, it's helpful to be able to look at it. So the first is that all the principles essentially are grounded, as Dan mentioned, in a respect for persons, the intrinsic value of every human being, persons as ends and not solely as means. Then out of those, sort of the four big principles that are referred to by some as the Georgetown mantra, because a couple of professors at Georgetown, Beecham and Childress, his name is spelled like Beauchamp, so I always have to think of it, Beecham and Childress, have really come as the experts and have written whole books about these four in particular. There is some argument within the field about whether any of these takes precedent to any others. Sometimes when I teach, I put autonomy right under respect for persons because the country has really focused, at least those of us who are working in and believing in Western medicine, has focused so much, because of being United States individualists, on autonomy as the primary principle, though these four are really the most important. Non-maleficence really means do no harm. Out of the Hippocratic Oath, that it is the responsibility and duty of healthcare professionals not to harm people. That primarily focuses on the duty of not killing, do not kill, but has been expanded over time in families' ideas and in patients' ideas to lots of other kinds of harms that we'll be talking about that will come up, and you'll see that. Beneficence, sort of the flip side, other side of the coin, if you will, of non-maleficence, which is to promote whole well-being or to do what is good for that person. Some ethicists lump the two and just say if you do one, you have to do the other. You don't harm somebody in order to help somebody. But I think it's more helpful when we're analyzing to split those two out because they're fairly distinct. There's also been some argument about what well-being means, and in whose opinion are we promoting well-being. We do add at the bottom here, and we underline it, that under these we are virtually always talking about the perspective of the patient, the person to whom treatment is being done or from whom treatment is being taken. Autonomy, as I mentioned, is primary for many, many folks in this country, and that talks about the individual's right to choose. In social work, we have our mantra, the self-determination of the client, constant. It is the person's right to choose. Under that, then flow some specific issues that we'll talk about through the week, and that is what constitutes informed consent. How can a person choose without knowing what the choices really are? And we'll talk about that some. Does that person have decision-making capacity, commonly and historically referred to as competence, though this is much more specific and clear? Can that person really choose? And what about people who can't choose? And who decides who can choose? And who has capacity? So that will come into play. Surrogacy is another concern. If people can't choose or don't have decision-making capacity, somebody must choose for them. And who is that in law and in ethics? And how does that come up?
I could just mention, surrogacy oftentimes comes in at the beginning and end points of life, when we're dealing with infants who obviously can't make decisions on their own behalf, or we're dealing with people who are in terminal stages of life, or accident victims, or people who are elderly with Alzheimer's who no longer have that ability. So we're beginning to see that many of these issues come in at the beginning points and the end points of life in very acute ways.
And that's how we've tried to design the case studies, some at the beginning and some at the end of life. Okay, the last of the big four, really, or out of the five, is justice. And that is looked at as defining what's fair, treating equal persons equally and unequal persons unequally. Obviously, we could do a whole week on justice in and of itself. But some of the other terms that come up are the notions of equality. Which two people are equal? How do we treat people equally? Reciprocity and equity. All concerns that come up with justice. There is some discussion now in the field of bioethics that justice ought to come up, flip up as number one. And that, why do you think that might be? Why are people talking more about justice?
Being an equity
in the healthcare. Yeah, lots of people are uninsured. People are sick of paying taxes. We have 14% of our healthcare, our GNP going to healthcare, the highest in the Western world, highest in the whole world. So some people are saying, look, in the era of managed care, in the era of uninsured people, this is what we need to be talking about. And they're talking about it from all sides of the fence, I might add, you know. So there's some conflict about that. But anyway, notions of justice will come up as we talk. Then some of these other principles flow from these, but will come up in the cases we'll be talking about. This is not the be-all, end-all list either, we'll say. There may be some others. We, for instance, didn't talk particularly about professional integrity, and some people say that's a principle in of itself, so that may come up. But flowing from autonomy, confidentiality, that individuals need to have control over information that is private about them. Who gets to know what information about somebody with AIDS or about somebody who wants an abortion and is a minor? I mean, how do we make those decisions? Honesty is the principle that says we must not deceive others. And related to that, the principle of fidelity, which is don't break trust that you've committed yourself to. Both of those become very important in bioethics with the notion of truth-telling. Must we always tell people the truth about their medical situations? Who should tell that truth? And as a physician, or I would expand it to other healthcare workers also, nurses and social workers, chaplains and other folks, how do we not betray the trust that is given us by our patients if we need to, for some other reason, overriding principle, break confidentiality, and so forth? So those will come into play a fair amount. Utility is the principle that many of you are commonly understanding as the greatest good for the greatest number. Something that is used as a basis for many, many decisions in ethics, not just bioethics, and that will come up. To maximize a person's social well-being or maximize the well-being of a group or of a community, of a nation. And again, though Dan said we're going to focus on individual cases, we always must keep in mind the macro or bigger picture, and we'll bring that in whenever we can and encourage you to. Last but not least is this notion of burden and benefit, which is also probably fairly familiar to many of you, related partially to beneficence, used fairly frequently when we're talking, you know, about specific cases. And that needs to be remembered, needs to be judged in relation to a person's whole well-being. What does that person deem as beneficial? What does that person deem as a burden to him or her, and that will come up in the case we'll do today. One thing you will notice by its absence, perhaps, is the notion of ordinary versus extraordinary treatments. That language is sort of out of use now, primarily because nobody can decide what's extraordinary and what's ordinary anymore. There has been a lot of controversy about that in the last 10 years, and I suspect that...
What do you mean by ordinary and extraordinary care?
Well, when I started doing ethical consultations as a medical social worker, that was those were the words we'd use. Well, it's ordinary to try to feed people. And then people would say, well, it's extraordinary to try to feed them with tubes through their noses into their stomach, or surgically implanted J-tubes, jejunostomy tubes, I think they're called, or jejunostomy, somebody would know that. And that's extraordinary care. That's not any more considered extraordinary care. It's very commonly done to feed people by tubes through their noses or into their stomachs. So the notion of extraordinary is evolving, and partly that's gone out with the coming in of living wills and advanced directives, because people would say, I don't want any extraordinary care, or don't keep me alive by extraordinary means. And 5 years later, that means something else. And if they're not able to say what they mean by that, we have to get more particular about what kinds of care we're talking about. Does that help?
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, the other aspect of it is historically or traditionally, ordinary care was expected as
that's
required.
The moral distinction.
Distinction. Yeah. We always have a duty to provide, for example, food and water to people. Whereas there may be certain things that were considered extraordinary care, which might not have been morally required to give to someone. But as technology keeps increasing, and as Mary's using an example, now food and water is being done through all these technological means. The lines become blurred, and what has become blurred as well is what is required to give to people versus what is an option but not necessarily required. And we'll see some cases where that comes up as well.
And we're trying not to do too much up and down, back, forth, but I think it kind of helps to have different people talking sometimes. I am going to get us started into a little bit of the...
Should we just see if there are some questions?
Yes, clarifications at this point before we...
You mentioned that the word ordinary and extraordinary has gone out of general communication. It seems like it maybe has, except all in the insurance field. Because they're the ones that, you know, are determining what extraordinary care.
They tend to... Yeah, and I... If you have more experience with it, we'll talk about it too. They often tend to use the term experimental versus approved, or versus assumed to be good because it's been proven to be good. But that is the same sort of distinction. I haven't seen recently in policies extraordinary or ordinary, but I have seen experimental versus
And that could be
approved. And I think it's a very similar, that's a very good point. Good clarification, yeah. Others? We're zipping through this. If today's your only day, you've gotten a taste. If you stay through Friday, you'll be able to use some of these a little more easily, too. Okay?
Can I say one other thing, too? My guess is that very little of what we presented so far is terribly surprising. A lot of this is based on common sense and our common notions of morality and society. But what it does is gives us a way to talk to each other about it and gives some clarity about it. And so when we begin to engage the actual conflicts, we can take a step back and say, okay, here's what's at stake here. Here's what's conflicting here. How do we think about that? How are similar cases been handled?
Okay, a lot of people, and you might need to move a little bit to see this if you can't quite, or you can listen
just move
as
it
we
to
talk.
The board.
We could move it over. Yeah, as I'm talking, why don't you do that? Why don't you run into it? Several people in the field have developed models for ethical decision making, and we'll say right at the outset that there are several different kinds of models. Some have 5 steps, some have 8 steps, some have 100 steps. I don't know. This model is fairly commonly used across the country for making decisions. I will also say at the outset that this is not a recipe for coming to the answer for an ethical dilemma. Because what I always say to my students, because they just get so frustrated at the end of our time with ethics, well, I still don't know what's the right answer. Ethical dilemmas are dilemmas. That means they're still dilemmas when you make a decision and do what you're going to do. It still means you won't go home saying, well, now I've got it figured out. You may go home with some gut-wrenching anxiety or angst about it. So they are dilemmas, and that's what we're focusing on. These kinds of models help to ensure that people have carefully thought through the moral ramifications of a decision or action they might make in a specific case. We accredit Dr. Ron Hamill with this six-step model. He's an ethicist at the Park Ridge Center for Faith and Ethics in Chicago. Again, very commonly used. The other thing I must say as a practitioner is, no, we don't always sit down and do this. There isn't always time. And you as family members or as people, individuals who will be affected by this, won't sit down necessarily on an evening and say to your spouse, let's go through these steps so we know what we're doing. On the other hand, if you are aware that there are some steps to help clarify the decision-making process, when you have to do it quickly, you will likely do it better quickly because you've heard about this stuff. And again, some of it might not be new to you. Some might be perfectly new to lots of you. So we'll just go through those quickly. I'm going to mention them, and then we're going to go through them with a case, a real case, okay? It's sort of split into two sections. First is to analyze the situation. We start with the case situation itself, not the principles. It's easy to jump right in quickly. And secondly, then we look at the moral or ethical dimensions of the situation and how we might make decisions. So the first is to gather whatever relevant facts or information need to be gathered. And it's easy in our country to get stuck right here because we always think more information means we'll get the answer. So we'll keep asking and digging. At some point you say, I have the information, now we move ahead. And you'll see that when we get to the cases. Secondly, identify whether this is truly a dilemma or not. Virtually every issue in healthcare is an ethical issue. It has to do with how we respond to each other as human beings. What is our course of action affecting somebody else's well-being? But is it a dilemma that takes this kind of model of decision-making to help try to resolve it? That's important, and we're talking this week primarily about dilemmas. I look at it and I think, did I spell it right? I think we spelled it right. Third, then, and not until you've done this, do you start to look at what are some of the alternatives we could do? What actions could we take in this situation? As a part of that, you need to look at the consequences. There's a whole stream in philosophy about thinking about consequences as being the most important. We need to look at consequences in terms of good ones and bad ones, short-term ones and long-term ones. This is often ignored in healthcare these days. And consequences for various affected parties, not solely the patient, but the family, maybe the institution, maybe society, maybe others, okay? Then you take the steps to look morally at what the options are. First is look at each of the alternatives you've come up with and the consequences related to those in light of whichever values and principles have come up as part of the dilemma or have come up as part of the relevant fact-finding for that person's life. What did she value? What was important in her life? In light of that, how would this alternative work in this situation? Fifth, it's important to assess underlying motives. Why are people choosing to do these alternatives? What's really behind the decision? And that'll come to light in the case we have today. You'll see why that's important. Last, and easily, in a very short period of time, choose an alternative, justify it. That's the hardest part. But ideally, when you get to here, you'll be choosing an alternative a little more carefully, a little more ethically, and it'll make the decision you make a little easier to bear in what is acknowledged to be a dilemma. Questions about that? We'll keep that up too, so that'll be helpful to look at. Yeah.
Somewhere in there, is there a home base from which to operate from?
You as the decision maker, you as the patient,
I guess you could break it down into individuals, but as a group process, too.
Yeah. That is often, and we'll get more specific about it as we do each case, is under relevant facts, we encourage people to look at their own groundings and their own values and principles, because often in a medical situation, there's a family member believing this, there's another family member believing this, there's a physician believing this, and a consultant believing this, consultant physician, and then the social worker or the chaplain comes in and says, well, what about this, let alone what the patient believes. Is that what you're meaning?
Yeah.
So to clarify the grounding or the lens through which each of us looks at the situation is very important and really is one of the ultimate goals we'd have of the week, that you would start to think about which of these principles means the most to you in light of your faith, in light of your philosophy of life, in light of your previous experience, whatever. Is that help, okay. Yeah.
Are you using the terms values and principles interchangeably?
No. Principles generally have to do with rules or assumptions. They can be the same, but there are some values that are not moral at all. I mean, I might value money. One could argue
aesthetic
about that.
Aesthetic values, an example.
Aesthetic, okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you could value, for example, a value that's really important in my family is education. But that would be a different sense there. In terms of the way we're using principles here, I think we're using primarily as what we call action guides. That is, the rules or the guidelines for conduct in given situations in that sense.
But it is important in a dilemma when we're trying to see, is this a dilemma or not? A value may conflict with a principle, or a value may conflict with another value, or a principle may conflict with a duty, or two duties may conflict. So the conflict can be through any of the above. And I think it's an important question to ask because people do often conflict the two. Think they're the same thing. And leave it to philosophers or theologians to, you know, pick it apart carefully. But here we're trying to use them differently. Okay, should we pass it out? Case study numero uno. You have a big thing there. Okay. This is called God and My Children Will Know What's Best. Does this sound like anybody's family situation? God and my children will know what's best. Okay.
What we're going to do during the week, we're going to continue to keep practicing the six-step model, and we will do together as a group always step number one, gathering the relevant facts and information, talking about that, reading the case over together. In general, after that, with the exception of today, we'll divide you into small groups of four or five people to work through the rest of the steps together. And then we'll come back as a large group and debrief it. Today, we're simply going to walk through this case together to give you a sense about how these six steps work in an actual case.
And because we're taping, I'm going to read it through as you read it through, so bear with me, so people listening to tape will know. Anna is a 61-year-old woman who is widowed. She's in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease to the point where she no longer speaks, walks, feeds herself, or recognizes family. She's lived in a nursing home for 4.5 years. She has a history of a repaired hip fracture and some bleeding, which the physician thinks is an indication of cancer. She's currently diagnosed with pneumonia, which if not treated through intravenous, that means into the vein directly, antibiotics, will result in her death. She has no living will, and when pressed earlier by her five children about what her wishes would be for treatment at the terminal stages of life, she responded, "God and my children will know what's best for me." She's a Lutheran pastor's wife and is a woman of deep faith. The five children are given the choice of whether to hospitalize Anna for IV antibiotics or not. If treated, the pneumonia would probably clear up, though the doctor has stated it is likely to recur again and again, probably ending her life within a matter of months. If untreated, Anna would likely die within a week. One of Anna's children is your best friend and asks your advice. What might you say to this friend to help the family make the decision? Now, in normal situations, we jump right in and answer that. What would you say to Anna? We don't want you to do that. We'd like you to refrain from doing that for a few minutes while we work through this stepwise process here. So knowing that's the case before you, what additional information or data might you think you need or want before you respond? Anything else that it's important to you think to know?
I would want to know if any of her children are out of the country and couldn't get back in a hurry.
Okay.
And I want to know if her children were satisfied that they had reconciled themselves with her, that they had said their goodbyes.
Okay.
We can just do this orally.
Okay. So you want to know if the kids, any of the kids are out of the country, and is each of them reconciled with Anna as a mother, said goodbye, feel comfortable if she's going to die. Okay? I think related to that is the issue of whether the kids have discussed this amongst themselves and agree on what they want to do or not. We didn't say that in here, did we? Okay. So there's a question of whether the kids agree. Why is that important?
Because you're going to have a big family rift if you don't.
Yeah. You'd have a big family rift after her death or before her death if you don't, and why else is it important?
Her statement was she wants to do what the God and the children will know.
That's right. That's right. She believed her children would know, so she assumed they would agree, and they are the decision makers here by law. All five of them. Nobody has any rights over anybody else, no oldest son, no oldest daughter. Right? So they have to agree. Or the doctor does what the doctor's going to do. Okay, what else might you need to know?
Well, do you need to know some financial stuff? What does the law say about, do they get to decide no matter who's paying?
Yes, that's a very good question. They get to decide no matter who's paying. In this situation, Anna is on welfare, public assistance. She's run out of her primary funds. The Lutheran Church doesn't give a lot of money for retirement. If you're a widow at 61, it means her husband was pretty young when he died. So she's run out of her savings, and her pension goes directly to the nursing home. It doesn't pay for it completely, so she's on public assistance. Your dollars and my dollars paying taxes, okay? The family still gets to decide. Anything else?
Where do each of the children stand in faith? Are they of a similar mind as she did?
Okay. Are the children of deep faith, as we said in here? What is their mindset about faith concerns in this situation? Another question here?
Well, I think it's some of the same thing. I think that I would like to know Anna's attitude towards death was, how she viewed death, as whether it was a process.
Okay, and that's a very important piece of step number one, which is, people refer to various things, world perspective, life history. Let's understand Anna a little better, because in this situation, it's a matter of substituted judgment. Anna is not competent to decide for herself, and the family has to do it. And in order to do it, we need to know what Anna would want in that situation. So some conversation needs to happen about that. I will tell you that Anna said, is as a person of deep religious faith, that there are worse things than death. And death is not the final thing. She believes in eternal life and looked forward to that through her life, as many people of faith do. I will also say that all the children are churchgoers and have a pretty strong faith. That doesn't mean they all agree with necessarily what that means in this particular situation, but God's working in lives was true across the board.
Do you think it makes a difference in this situation whether there is a pastoral leadership available to the kids to remind them of all of our promise of a life to come, and that we're in a process that's going to move through this life and something else?
Yeah, I suspect in this family that would be important. Be difficult to find, since she's a widow of a Lutheran pastor. He was the pastor for the family in some ways. But that kind of guidance would be very helpful. So in that situation, I would suggest bringing in somebody with the family. That might be helpful to point that out. What does our tradition say? What is it that that her husband and she maybe believed as Lutheran pastor and widow?
I would want to know, and since she no longer speaks, walks her feet herself, but if she's in physical discomfort, like pain, of any kind with that hip fracture and stuff, does she have chronic pain? How does she feel physically?
It's hard to tell in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's how much pain people might be in. She doesn't give any indications. She doesn't groan. She doesn't grimace. She doesn't walk. The fracture was fixed when she was still walking. So likely not, but we can't know for sure. So that's a tough and important question.
I'd like to know what the level of the commitment is for the different children. Is there one that's been the primary caretaker that has to handle the affairs and go visit and do all those types of things? Are they equally shared?
Mm-hmm. Part of this discussion is how much information I give you and how much I don't. In this situation, the children were pretty equal according to their gifts and stations in life in their commitment and their care for Anna. Pretty equal. Some lived further away, some lived closer. They cared for her a long time before she was in the nursing home, which she's been for 4.5 years. So she really is at end stage. She'd had it for 10.
I think they have enough info.
Yeah, okay. See what I mean? We could spend 15, 20 minutes on getting more info, could we not? And at some point, we have to decide. The doctor maybe is saying, by 3 o'clock today, we need to know what to do. So we have to stop. Okay, second step is identify the dilemma. Is there one? In other words, which of the principles we've mentioned are relevant here? Where are those principles? Over here? Any of those relevant, first off? Before we talk about if any conflict, which one of these come into play?
Are the doctors willing for the family to make the decision?
Yeah, the doctors are willing.
Yeah. They're not going to insist on following a medical procedure.
No. Not a doctor knows best situation here. An autonomy situation. He points out autonomy is Anna's decision, but since she can't decide, it is her family's decision. That's a principle.
Number two strikes me right away as being basic principle of
non. Yeah, tell me about that. Do not harm in what way?
Well, you know, the choice here to me is, I mean, I read the question here, and I didn't go to any of these steps. I would answer it in an entirely different way.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the answer, too, is that you have a choice here of if you do not harm by saying, well, we want to withhold any treatment, then you can portray that as being harmful because it is going to probably cause termination soon.
Okay.
So that's a real...
Non-maleficence, very important here.
But I've also heard pneumonia, heard by healthcare professionals referred to as the old person's
friend.
Angel or whatever.
Friend, yeah.
And that's really a good way to go. And I also have heard testimony from nursing home operators that non-intubation with pneumonia creates a much more peaceful death. That intubation, forcing liquids, creates a sense of panic and drowning in people that doesn't happen if they just are offered sips of water.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could say it would be doing harm to force any intubation.
Okay. Yeah, non-maleficence can be a conflict in and of itself here, but you bring up a number of things, Ingrid. One is the tomb intubation in this situation isn't quite the right term. Intubation generally refers to putting somebody on a respirator to breathe for them. That wasn't even part of the consideration, though it could well be if she couldn't breathe. But usually respirators aren't used at end-stage Alzheimer's anymore. However, that's an issue. You were using it in terms of forcing fluids.
Mm-hmm.
Intubation is not really the word for that, but it is forcing fluids by using tube. It's putting a tube down again and putting fluids in. Or in this case, it's IV fluids. So it is putting a tube directly into the vein, here or here or wherever they can get a vein. One might argue with somebody at end-stage Alzheimer's who doesn't weigh very much, that can be very painful, trying to start an IV and keep it going, and forcing fluids. And then the issue of if you want this person to be hydrated or have enough fluids and the person already has pneumonia, this sense of drowning can be very distressing and painful. So the issue of doing harm, causing death, or allowing death, however we put it, or causing harm with the IVs is the issue here. However, we try to make it simple because a lot of people are dealing with all of those. Should we force fluids? Should we force food? And should we force IV antibiotics? We chose to just look at the antibiotics. It's hard enough. Other principles?
9 and 10, I think both in terms of...
Yeah, talk about utility. What? How so?
Well, the stress on the 5 kids for... I mean, that's a dilemma there, because are their lives richer or not for having a relative in this situation? I mean, would it be... Well, that's a dilemma. And then same thing for society. I guess the question of if it's Medicare or Medicaid, then that whole issue of cost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be a more classic use of the greatest good for greatest number, so we can get the social welfare and the whole thing of scarce resources
society. And this family did talk about that. They felt bad that public dollars were being used to maintain their mother in this situation.
But the whole dilemma is whether or not that should even be decisions of families beyond a certain point. Right. I mean, do you keep someone alive indefinitely? How do you balance societal needs?
Well, yeah, that's why I was asking, did the kids have the power to make the complete decision? Because I suppose in some countries, if there were a rationing of health care in any sense, then the decision would not completely rest with the kids.
Right, and I would argue that we're there already in this country in some ways. But in this situation, the kids have complete control. But do they necessarily agree about that? No.
What did you say about number 10 here, Barbara? Are you doing burden benefit as well?
Well, there too. I mean, whether the family is burdened, you know, that whole. How the structure of their lives is affected, but it could be a great benefit.
Well, and burden benefit as a principle generally needs to refer just to the person, the patient. Very commonly looked at as an issue for the family. Does not mean that's not an issue. But when we use the term as a principle, isn't that accurate to say, yeah, what might the burden on the family come under here? Justice?
It's a good question. I mean, we're really moving
persons,
into the whole question of the consequences, assessing good and bad consequences long term, short term, into that area. But it's how do you bring in the effect on the other family members? And this is a great concern for people. Part of what we're facing in here, in the broadest sense, there's a whole general category where sometimes you're just sanctity of life versus quality of life issues, and that's very much one here. And people who are strongly rooted in sanctity of life, that life of itself is of such sacred value that it must be maintained regardless. Part of their concern is once you start moving away from that, then people can become defined as burdens and as disposable after a certain point. And their concern is that it can lead to justification for certain people no longer being worth having around. And therefore, they will strongly emphasize a sanctity of life, a respect for life position in all these situations.
That's also the important place to bring in this earlier gathering relevant facts about Anna's life and belief. She was of the belief that life was sacred and a gift from God. She was also a nurse, and she knew about quality of life and talked about that a lot in her practice. But when it came time to telling her kids what she would want, she deferred and said, God will take care of it, and I'll trust you all to decide.
The burden benefit in this kid's situation would be, would the potential benefit that Anna would receive from the antibiotics, would that be outweighed by the burden that she would experience about the invasiveness of the tubes, potential pain, these kinds of things? Or would the benefit outweigh the burden, judged from her perspective, which of course is a substitute of judgment now? Hard to know.
She will most likely get it again soon and go through the same thing.
So it's 3 more months of life.
At whatever level, not eating, not talking, not walking, not knowing your family, So it really is sanctity of life, quality of life. That's the major dilemma. We could come up probably with others, but we should probably move.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to utility for a second. As a society, the greatest good you could argue is not spending the money on someone who's essentially dying and a vegetable anyhow. You could also argue, as a society, that a society is only as good as the way it treats its members, and we don't want to live in a society that views people as disposable, so that it would harm our sort of social psyche to say we would make these decisions financially. So you could go
so that might be a dilemma as justice for society versus the sanctity of life.
Yeah, very good point in there, because that's an important one we'll come back to.
The broader, bigger one. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's just generate a couple of alternatives, 2 or 3. What are the choices? Yeah, sorry.
I wanted to comment on the dilemma things. It seems to me that the main dilemma here is the dilemma to the family. I don't see the dilemma as far as Anna is concerned. It seems that any treatment is going to deny her the opportunity to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. It won't improve her quality of life. So the dilemma is what the family looks at.
Right. And the family's dilemma is similar, the sacredness of Anna's life versus the quality of her life, and how she would define quality. Is that life of Christ? Is that life on this earth in this situation? That's their dilemma, because they don't really know. really what Anna would want, because she's not there to tell him and wouldn't when they asked her. Does that help? It's messy.
Part of the issue you bring up is once you make a choice to begin to intervene in end-of-life situations, which could be providing aspirin, which could be, I mean, once you start doing medical intervention in what we could define as a natural course of life, at what point do you stop it? At what point do you say, okay, now it's in God's hands? But we as a society have made choices with our healthcare system to intervene in increasingly more and more involved ways. And that's what creates the dilemmas. It used to be end-of-life situations took care of themselves. You used palliative care. You tried to alleviate suffering, but you weren't really prolonging life. Now we can prolong so-called life, however we define that, almost indefinitely. So now at what point do we say it's in God's hands?
Well, if we really believe that life is a continuum, mm-hmm. you know, that goes from this form of existence to the next, mm-hmm. What are we doing by any treatment to someone like Anna? Mm-hmm.
Is there still a prevalent view that the only good death is a natural death?
Well, I think if you probably surveyed everybody you know, they'd say, yeah, but how do you define natural death anymore? The AMA has said that between 80 and 90% of us will die a managed death, which means that these decisions will be made by somebody for us, or about us, or with us if we're competent and can make the decisions. But 80 to 90% of us aren't going to sort of have a heart attack watching the sports on TV, which I would deem a natural death.
Yeah, dying in your sleep.
Dying in your sleep is a natural death, right. But you ask everybody, they say yes, and then you ask everybody, is that going to happen? They say no, it's not. Not unless our society changes.
Given our time, why don't you just simply walk us through the next steps and talk about what actually happened in the case? Because you'll have a chance to have a lot more time with each of the individual cases, but we want to sort of walk through this one here.
Yeah, in this case, the alternatives primarily were give IVs or don't. The nursing home wouldn't do it, because they're not that high-level skilled. So it meant going to the hospital. It meant transporting somebody who was already very demented and confused and had a broken hip repaired already. So the family said, well, we either need to give IVs or not give IVs. Consequences, if you give it, she'll probably recover from this pneumonia, probably get it again soon, probably another time, and another time. We'll have to do this several times, and she'll die one of the times, probably of something else. Maybe her heart gives out after so much pneumonia. Short-term and long-term, needed to talk about it. If you don't give it, she'd probably die within a week. And that means the family goes through a vigil at the bedside, and that means consequences for the nursing home staff, also needing to watch this happen. Lots of controversy about what's involved with being with dying dehydrated and starving. Is that terrible? Is that okay? What is it? Is it a friend or not? Looking at the alternatives in light of relevant values and principles, in this case, the family really decided that Anna's belief in God and her belief in everlasting life were the overriding groundings for a decision for her. The family, yes, was tired, had taken care of her for a long time. You know, the money was an issue. Talked about the family feeling bad that there was money being spent and so forth, but it was really sacredness of her beliefs. Underlying motives, yeah, was the family trying to have her die so they could get her life insurance sooner? Because
I just make one, just back up, yep. Just one step on that. So what you're saying then is autonomy and substituted judgment. What would Anna have wished was the overriding principle? If we begin to look at the different things we identified as it being involved here, family decision was respecting Anna's wishes, respecting her autonomy as best as could be discerned.
And then doing that in order to be beneficent, which is to say, for Anna, whole well-being involved the spiritual dimension of her belief in Christ, that she would be with God after her death. That is whole well-being, so that we were being beneficent in this situation if we decided to not do the IVMIX. Underlying motives, I was saying the family was, yeah, maybe tired of doing it and wanted to see an end to it. You know, did they feel she was suffering? Was there motive to relieve her suffering? Question about that. It's hard to know how much she was suffering. Were they suffering? Who was really suffering? So that was a difficult one to sort of distinguish, I think, for this family. As it came down, and we should end it probably here, I'll hang on with the tape, is that the family chose not to treat Anna with antibiotics, gave her rectal morphine suppositories to help her breathing, slow her breathing, gave her oxygen to ease her breathing. Again, some interventions, however, interventions that weren't going to heal or treat the pneumonia, but to ease the dying. Unlike the doctors said, Anna lived about 8 days in a very debilitated state. He thought it would be 3-4 days, and the family stayed round the clock for virtually 8 days waiting for her to die. She didn't seem to be in distress, was quite peaceful, had no response whatsoever, but really hadn't been responding earlier. So with the oxygen, with the morphine suppositories, she passed away in her sleep. Natural? I don't know. Happened.
And did the kids fight?
And the kids didn't fight. No.